Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight, we have another great show dealing with metaphysics and spirituality, and also some elements of science and other interesting elements of life itself, since this show is Why Life Is. And a spiritual review tonight of a book that I wrote, a novel called Afterlife Love. And there are many parts of it that are not truly made up. So we can say that there's some parts that we could call artistic novel, and then other parts that probably would be more of a factual explanation of certain things and teaching and actual incidences that did take place. But regardless of that, and I'm not going to reveal which is which, because a lot of times people say, oh, I want to know if this really happened or whatever. But I guess the one thing I can say is that everything that took place in another dimension of time and space, to as far as my recollection and understanding is completely accurate and actually happened. But things that may have happened in other than another dimension of time and space may be a composite of a couple of issues or characters and things like that. And I want to, at this point, say the reason I want to do tonight's show is because this is a novel or book that is seriously misunderstood at times. And I thought to kind of bring in a better understanding about what the book is about, and then to kind of go through it in a spiritual discussion way. We can then come to at least, not everybody will agree with me, but look, I can at least give people some viewpoint of what the book is trying to accomplish, and how come I wrote it the way I wrote it, and how come it turned out the way it did, and that sort of thing. And I think that for a lot of people, this may be help, because some people read this book and they have as many questions when they're done with it. Not because it is unclear, but because they want to kind of understand a little better what the book is trying to tell them. Not that they doubt even any of the incidents in the book. So a lot of people say, well, this seems like it's completely consistent with my philosophy, my way of life, everything. But they still have this question. The question is, okay, what are you as the author trying to get through to us? And that's what I hope tonight's show will delve into and maybe bring some light to. So let's talk about, what is this? It's an Afterlife Love. It's a book about love in the afterlife. Love, in this case, is the meaning of love between two people in an intimate relationship, and not just love, but includes this, but not just love between friends or relatives or we'll say other types of loving relationships, as well as the universal value of love. So that all is inclusive within the context of the book and is meant to come through. But obviously the story is centered around the intimate kind of love that includes sexuality between two people who have an amazing history together. Now, the history is not so much in the lifetime that the book covers, but more to do with some elements of prior lifetimes, little bits and pieces of which do appear throughout the story as an explanation for various things. However, most of the book is not about past life. It's really about the existing life, and how it's necessary for sometimes people who have intimate relationships and have had prior lives together to work out some of the elements of those prior lives So their present lifetime, not just while they're physically alive, but also continuing into the afterlife, how that has to be considered, and they may have great concerns about it. And this is not an uncommon tale. This is a subject that happens more often than not among a lot of people in intimate relationships. And you might say, well, how do you know that? Well, I have had out-of-body experiences, and I have met a lot of people on the other side of the physical world, which is called the astral world. And in that context, I have met quite a few of the people that I met have continued in having a relationship that at one point, maybe even up until the time they died, was an important one to them in the physical world. And sometimes there's another afterlife past the astral called the monastic or mental world. And those lives sometimes continue even in that realm, although with some hiatuses caused by people reflecting for considerable periods of time about their overall life. And when they're doing that, they're not interacting even with the most intimate of people. So there is that element to it, and that this can go on for very long periods of time, which we'll get into tonight, and I'll explain how long those can be. And for a lot of people, this may be significant if they're involved in an intense, close relationship and intend, whether or not it will happen, but they intend to continue this relationship even beyond the physical life. Now, in most religions, the physical life is all that is discussed about things such as marriage and the intimacy of sexual union. So most marriages are based not upon this spiritual extra understanding that we will be investigating tonight. Instead, they are amazingly short and, we'll say, very limited, because in many respects, the authors and creators of the religion, be it, whether you believe it or not, humans or beyond that, but we'll say for the human part of any creation of a religion, the aspects that most of those humans incorporate have been very limited about afterlife issues, and instead have focused strongly on the physical. So many religions say, till death do you part. And that is incorporated not only in the question of the bond of, say, a marriage, but it also means in terms of the intimacy of sex, which is a very special way of relating to another person. And it is, because of that, critical to understanding afterlife love in terms of a sexual intimacy. And so it colors everything, changes the very nature of the context of the relationship. Now, that's a little conceptual there, and I will get into the examples of this, so it'll be more understandable in a few minutes. But the point is that what I'm trying to say here is that in our society in general, and I'm not talking about just here in the United States, but throughout most of the more developed countries in the world, it is pretty much an accepted practice that the relationship ends at the point of physical death. And it's seldom expressed in most religions otherwise. And there are some religions in which it's believed that if, quote-unquote, in a man-woman relationship, if the husband dies, the woman should soon follow or die with the husband. Those are pretty radical approaches. And the intention there is hard to fully fathom, because the respect for life is a godly thing, and the idea that someone should die at the exact same time as their spouse has within it tainted a very onerous and even dark side to it. So it's difficult to rationalize that kind of thought. At least in my mind it is. Now, maybe others have a different viewpoint than that. Some do, obviously. But I'm saying that in any case, this is a kind of quirky way of looking at the relationship of love and how it can last. But it may be that the idea that people can't be separated by time and space is a way of losing the spiritual side rather than gaining it. It's unfortunate that we have to examine all these things, and we tonight will do so within the context of this this novel. Now, let me tell you a bit about the novel so that we have some we'll say, gist of what the story is about. First of all, in a very kind of obtuse way, I appear in the novel. For those of you who are familiar with Slaughterhouse 5 and, you know, all those kinds of pretty strange books where the author sometimes enters the novel, and no, I don't believe I'm schizophrenic, but the point is that I'm not even the main character, much less the story is so little about me that it is it's more like I'm a prop. But still, I am in the book, as well as some other people I know, because the novel takes from the real lives of these people and incorporates a really great story. The book primarily centers around two people who meet each other in a fashion in which one of them, the woman in this case, her name in the novel is Rebecca. And her position is a more conscious one, in which she has led in the last couple of lifetimes, including the one that she's in, a more spiritual life, a kind of life that could only be described as, we'll say, a spiritually disciplined life, and one in which spiritual service to her is of a prime motive. This is dear to my heart, so of course the fact that it appears in the novel is of no coincidence. It's certainly a projection of what I would perceive to be a admirable life, and one that has great meaning and would produce within itself, regardless of whether she meets someone of significance in her life or not, great results in terms of being meaningful, providing and giving to the world, and treating people as souls rather than personalities. And it would be a life in which there was the sort of exemplary behaviors that one would hope to see in any person. It's generally a good person, we could call it, a fairly good person life, you know. Maybe not the greatest, because no person that is human is going to have perfection. Perfection by its own standards, in human terms, would be outside of human ability. So we don't strive or seek to be perfect people. We seek to be noble people, which means we try to do the best we can at any one time, and we seek to be good people, which means that we seek to follow the light or thought of God, and create more of it in the form around us, which is a virtuous life. So that's a good thing. So Rebecca is one of these people. She's a great, we'll say, student and maybe teacher of what I call the ageless wisdom, but you can just call it spiritual principles, or the trying to promote a more and better world, a godly world, one in which we could really say that there's something significant in this person. Now, in her story, there's this realization in her young adult years, during her 20s up to the age of 28 plus, that she is going to meet the significant love of her last lives, and she would be challenged to deal with this person, because this man that she assumes she's going to meet, she already knows is going to have some of the problems that she knew they had in prior lives together. And she's perplexed by this, because she absolutely believes this is going to happen to her. This is before the book actually starts, so this is happening in a period of time in which we're not really privy to what's going on in her. You just see the results of it in terms of her personality and her soul search. And so she knows she's going to meet this individual, but she doesn't know exactly how or when. She just has this, we'll call it, inner thought coming possibly from some contact with her soul, and some people call it the altered soul, which is her solar angel or inner guide, is telling her that to be prepared for this potential circumstance, and to realize that it's going to eventually take place. And the perplexing nature of it is that she remembers that this man that is going to enter her life has unusual levels of conflict about his own way of dealing with women and sexuality. And it doesn't even mean that he wasn't even a female in some prior lives, but she believes in this life he's going to be male again, regardless of what he's been in the past, male or female, because these things can't change. But she recognizes that he's going to have a kind of dual conflict. One is that he's going to become somewhat infatuated with her, and on a superficial level, be seeking to be sexual with her. And at the same time, he is going to be unable to express his love towards her sexually, and to which he finds difficult, and is going to have a number of conflicted ways of relating to her that will forestall and even maybe eventually destroy what would be a great relationship for the two of them. And this is something she's aware of, but she doesn't know how or when it's going to take place. So she has all this, we'll call it, inner knowledge that is going on, and it is happening in a way in which you could say that she is a person who does not have, at least in the realistic sense, a expectation for full success, because she has seen things go badly in prior lives. And that's even when she had some of the same understanding in even the last prior life and was unable to fix the issues and problems. So we have an immediate, we'll say, conflictive angst about the whole situation coming from her knowledge, which she also realizes is going to be far beyond probably the level of consciousness that he's going to have when she meets him. So that is a, that you can see already there is this unfortunate, we'll say, dilemma, and one in which only one of the main characters is cognizant of what's going to take place. And you can ask yourself, well, why would this be such a terrible thing? And you have to kind of look at this from the standpoint that when their prior relationships took place, the world was not a modern world as we understand it today. the world was a world in which the male aspect was oftentimes controlling and sometimes arbitrary in its ways of dealing with sexual feelings and feelings in general. And so that leads us into our male character. Now, he's an interesting fellow. He has a very brilliant mind. He's a computer engineer, designs computer processors, microprocessors. And he works for a big company that does this. And he has a fairly advanced degrees. He's a smart guy. But in terms of his relationships with women, even when he was young, he had almost no success. Continuously, he creates for himself the conflicts from his past and recreates them in ways that revolve around both sexuality and sensuality and an inability to become connected in a meaningful, close way with a woman. So his overall response for, we'll say, all of this particular lifetime until he meets Rebecca is kind of like in a fog. He's not completely conscious of why he's having these kinds of strange relationships. He has a best friend who's in some way similar to him as far as women, girls, and then women in their lives are concerned. And but strangely, his best friend is actually more conscious by far than he is, even though they're both close to each other's intelligence levels. The friend is more conscious, and he never recognizes that. What does that mean? Consciousness. What does it mean to be more conscious? The friend is actually more loving than he is. And this best friend, who he thinks as a fellow, we'll say, explorer of the world together, it explores from a much greater way of being inclusive of his environment. His knowledge is applied more evenly. He's more open-minded. And all of this is taking place, but our main character doesn't get it. And you may ask yourself, well, how could he not get that? That sounds so strange if he's the best friend. Because in his case, he was projecting so much of himself onto this other fellow that he pretty much thought they were like twins almost, and they didn't recognize much of the differences between them. This is a part of the story that's not clear to the reader until maybe past the middle of the book. So it's something the reader, just like the main character, he is suffering through trying to understand his own friend, and so is the reader. The reader's trying to say, who is this guy that is the friend? Is he just like the main guy, or is he sort of like, you know, somebody else? And this is one of the ideas in the book to bring the reader into a better understanding of the difference between knowledge and consciousness. Two people can have virtually the same levels of knowledge, meaning they're virtually the same in intelligence. One might be slightly different, it doesn't matter. But their consciousnesses can be significantly different. And here was an example put deliberately into the book so that the reader could see that that's a reality of life. Many people, when they think of spiritual subjects, forget or don't know that knowledge is not a means of understanding. Understanding comes from this level of consciousness, which really comes from how much you love, how much you are inclusive, how much your mind is open and not closed. Knowledge does not provide those things, and it may block them in some circumstances. So it isn't a means of achieving high consciousness. A lot of people don't know that, and this book helps to reveal that in its own ways. So here's part of the review, as we're talking about tonight, about this book, is that it has right from the get-go, right from the very beginning, the seeds for understanding the difference between this great enigma that many people have between consciousness and knowledge. Truly conscious, high consciousness people have amazingly meaningful lives, whereas people who are relatively low in consciousness but may have great knowledge of many things lack the meaning in life, oftentimes have a great sadness, maybe even a depression about life. And so we end up with these things that are so amazingly common, yet we don't understand why, and this is one of the ways this book kind of reveals this particular issue. Now, eventually, the two meet, the two main characters. And in the initial meeting, which takes place, just happens to take place, at a real event that I conducted in this area where I live. And these people meet. Now, when they meet, the woman is, of course, aware immediately. Like, oh, there he is. Oh, God, there he is. What am I going to do? What am I going to do? And so here is where the main female character has all this understanding of the situation. And, of course, the male has nothing in this situation other than some kind of strange sensation, like maybe I know her from somewhere. It's something, and he notices her noticing him more than he notices anything else. The interesting thing is that his friend, who's with him, the friend, he immediately becomes attracted to our main star of the book, the woman, because she's more conscious, and he's in the same level, or around the same level. Not quite as conscious as she is, but he's at least closer. And he says, wow, there's a really conscious babe. He's attracted to her from her consciousness. And our male character, unfortunately, he's not. Because he can't recognize it. He doesn't see it in his best friend. He's not going to see it in her right away. And so he's kind of dumbfounded by what's happening. Literally, he falls into the situation, and she has to basically take charge because she realizes that he's not going to probably respond to her. She knows his consciousness is going to be so low that he's not going to really even understand her and may even be afraid of her. And for sure, it may not be attracted to her, which is kind of an odd thing. So she takes it into her own hands to bring about the relationship. Literally, she demands or commands the relationship right from the beginning. She chooses to direct how and in what ways they're going to relate. Recognizing all the foibles, all the problems that they've had in past relationships. So she's got the wisdom for what she can get out of her consciousness to make choices far better than he does. This is where she's really, we'll say, choosing to create a new kind of relationship with this old love. And the challenge is, can she do that with all the obstacles that he's going to throw up that she knows from past times? And he may find some new ones as well. And is she going to be able to succeed in what is going to be a very, very rocky time, in at least the beginning? This is how the story is starting to immediately move just in the first chapter. This is the setup that we are experiencing. Now, a lot of people, unfortunately, skim read. And when you do that with this book, you miss a lot of the things I just said. And that's the problem with this book, is it's kind of dense. It has a lot of words and a lot of explanations for what's going on, but if you skim it, you miss the finer details, which enrich the story and allows the person to be able to get a deeper meaning from it. And a lot of people dismiss even what I just mentioned at the beginning of the book. A lot of people don't get what's going on. They read the story and then just it's like, okay. They're not. And again, the reader is put in the position of reading the book deliberately from the man's perspective. And a lot of people got on my case about that, especially some women, because they thought I was writing it for the man's perspective because I'm a man. I wrote it from the man's perspective because I wanted the reader to discover for themselves higher consciousness, and it was easier to do it if they were experiencing the limited consciousness of the male's viewpoint than the female's. I wanted them to get the difficulty he had in not understanding by them not understanding. But you don't get that full not understanding if you skim read it. And that's one of the problems. So I recommend for all those who have read or are about to read this, I think, pretty good book, that you take the time to read the whole thing. Don't read, like, a couple paragraphs of the first chapter, then switch to the second, that sort of thing. Or, I love to read the end of the book, you know, kind of. That isn't going to help. Because this is a book that's a journey in consciousness, as much as it is a journey, as you're going to see in tonight's show, through time and space and remarkable, remarkable kinds of experiences that most people don't even know about. So this is a truly amazing book. Now, one of the things that I might run into tonight is I may run out of time. If I do, we'll just continue the show next week. This is one of these times when I don't feel so bad about having a second show about this, because people can read the book and they can catch up and they can also re-listen to the show. So you can kind of do both if in case we don't get far enough along where I think we've covered the subject well enough. But this is a lot to talk about. Remember, I'm not going to go detail by detail, and it's not like I'm reading you the book. This is a review in spiritual terms of what the book is attempting to do, and it's also attempting to try to reach out to the reader from a perspective of change, because our main character, the fellow, he is in a, what we'll call it, a real pickle and a lot of problems because of his lack of consciousness. And the reader can identify and gradually grow in consciousness with him. Even if you have high consciousness, this is still an experience in those events, and well worth it. Worth it to read instead of skim. Or, we'll say, pass over the parts that seem to be maybe not of great enough interest for some reason. All right, so these two immediately, from the moment they meet, our woman hero in the book, she is going to take him and bring him to a new level of consciousness, and she knows she doesn't have a lot of time based upon past incidences, that if she doesn't immediately address some of the problems that they had before, she believes, probably rightly so, that he will react negatively to her. And sure enough, even before she takes the hand and invites him to leave this meeting with her, he's already thinking, well, she's really not my type. I don't know what's going on, but probably just not my kind of gal. And was thinking of all the reasons why he wouldn't want to pursue her any further. And she's, of course, realizing that that's what's going to happen. So she says, well, how would you like to come back to my place? And, of course, his immediate thought is, oh, good, an easy sexual experience here. And she doesn't try to change that idea in his head because she knows it's going to be probably his immediate, relatively childish motivation in getting the door. So she says, oh, sure, yeah, come on, let's go back to my place. And she's even a little bit on the suggestive side, but not anything extreme. But the point is that it's his friend that's really interested in her. And, of course, she immediately befriends the friend. And he, strangely, gets immediately jealous, and he can't figure out why, because he doesn't even like her that much. So there is the enigma, right there. Here's a guy that is so driven by his subconscious, he doesn't even know what he's doing. And his friend kind of immediately catches on, there's something strange going on here between these two people. But he doesn't want to address it either, because after all, he's interested in her too. So we have kind of a little bit of a triangle going on, but she goes ahead and leaves with him, and with the main man in the book, and leaves the friend there, which in her mind should be a comforting statement to some extent, and it is a little bit. He's a little bit more encouraged. And they go back and to her house, and she starts talking to him about spiritual things and metaphysics and stuff he thinks is goofy and ridiculous, and thinks that she's a nutcase, and probably all he wants to do is see if he can get into bed with her and leave or whatever at the beginning of this whole experience. But then it goes a bit deeper. And she tries to correct, in his mind, this superficial way of seeing her and any woman. And immediately has a breakthrough. I don't want to tell you all the substances of what's going on, because I don't want to ruin the story for you. But she does have this breakthrough with him right there. First night. And nothing major goes on. But what immediately is established is that he is bewildered by his extremely strong feelings upon his leaving her and not realizing how or why this could possibly be happening. Although she does reveal to him that they have potentially a past life together, which he doesn't believe in. But it doesn't matter. He's so bewildered by the relationship that it starts to break down some of these defenses that he has been employing throughout his life, and some of the demeaning and less admirable ways he has seen women, some of it caused by anger that he had towards our main woman character in prior lifetimes. So she's doing, like, you could call it active psychoanalysis and other things, true psychotherapies, on this guy from not just the angle of what he is today, but how he was in prior lifetimes. And it's pretty remarkable. From the reader's standpoint, the reader is now experiencing our woman as a being who now is directing the process. And from the eyes, the reader is experiencing it from the eyes and mind of the man. And so you get the feeling, whether you're a woman or a man reading a book, it doesn't matter, that she is truly showing some kind of exceptional consciousness and love that's new. And you get the experience of him from that standpoint. Truly, truly amazing. Okay, so the book continues. And as it does, we're going to come back to some of the elements. But I'm going to be mostly talking about the spiritual aspects and not so much the events on a moment-to-moment basis. Hopefully, at this point, this has really got you thinking, well, wow. Maybe there's more to the story than I had read before, or maybe I'd like to read this. If so, that's great. And we will be back in about 2.5 minutes from right now.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. McFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight we are speaking, I am speaking, about a spiritual review of Afterlife Love. This is a book I wrote, though, I think it's been about 9 years ago. And this book has some very interesting and intricate elements dealing with spiritual issues. That's what I'm really dealing with tonight. So we're going to continue sort of discussing the story, but it's not so much about the story as what the elements of spiritual change are and how it is that these characters can so promote, we'll say, in the reader's mind, a new and better understanding of both metaphysics and spiritual life. So, we're talking about the main female character being very conscious and a true good example, we'll say, a great example of someone who's spiritually disciplined in their life and has a meaningful life, a very creative life. I'll talk about some of those factors right now. What is she like? Again, her name was Rebecca, in the book, of course. And so the interesting thing about her is that she has in her consciousness both the ability to be group conscious or soul conscious and share individual consciousness on an equal footing, which is what Ageless Wisdom is about and what the teachings that I do are about. People should be both, we'll say, amazing individuals in their consciousness, be able to be creative, be able to interrelate new things coming from themselves in totally, we'll say, unique ways, while at the same time being able to work with others as souls and collectively to support each other but not extinguish each other's individuality, but rather enhance it. This is part of what Ageless Wisdom suggests and is also a great teacher for us to realize. It has to do with the nature of what a soul really is. A soul is both an individual and a group conscious being of equal nature. It's the, we'll say, the superlative sense of what a human being is supposed to reach. Most human beings are very little in group consciousness and highly individual, but not highly conscious in their individuality, unfortunately selfish, sometimes bitterly so. And so in order to reach a soul level of consciousness, they have to take, a human being has to take their individual sense of self and expand it to a higher level called the higher self. And at the same time, within this hugely creative state, be able to work with others who are equally creative and conscious, and who they all respect each other together, and they can build a spiritual hierarchy of consciousness and develop it together. It takes a lot of work. There are many successes and some failures, or sometimes as many failures with some successes. But as we do this, as each of us does this, over many, many lifetimes, it promotes the development of our soul, and it makes and helps others to become the same way. That's the principles of Ageless Wisdom, and it takes usually both a group to do it, so you got to have a group of people trying to work together. They may not even call it a spiritual group, or they may. And in any case, it also has to be individual. So people have to be able to be creative on their own and have to be willing to take the risks and difficulties of being an individual. Both have to be consistently delved into and developed. And this comes from the two parts of God's mind. The first part is freedom, creativity, purpose. The second part is consciousness, planning, direction, love, inclusiveness. Those have to come together. Those two parts have to come together to create a truly spiritual being. Because that's the part of God's mind. When you bring it together, those two parts equal God's thought. And God's thought is what we call spiritual. So that's where it comes from. Now, in Afterlife Love, Rebecca is the person who is most soul-like. She is the example of what our male characters, I should probably give him a name, that's his name in the book is Shane. Why don't we give his friend, remember I told you about his friend was called Craig. I don't want to give you a lot of names, the book has like 60-some-odd names, so we can't go through all those names, we'll get confused. But we'll keep those three in context, so we can at least talk about them that way. All right, so from Shane's perspective, Rebecca is completely confusing to him. In prior lives, he's been angry with her, and even in very hostile ways, he was untruthful to her. He was untruthful to others about her in prior lives. And so he did a lot of nasty things. Those nasty things collectively were the, we'll say, karmic intrusions that would prevent him from developing the kind of relationship that Rebecca wanted to have with him, and Shane may have wanted to have with someone, but was being blocked by all of the illusions that he has carried with him. Okay, so in this story, Rebecca's plan is to make sure that she breaks through the illusions of Shane about sexual intimacy as early as possible in the relationship. Now, you might say, why? What's the big deal? Well, the big deal was that several times in prior relationships together, he had become unusually jealous of her, and at the same time, had illicit, we'll call it, or wrongful sexual contact with other women, either because of his own illusions about her or because of his own, we'll say, sexual urges being more important as desires or glamours, fixed desires, to be met than to be intimate with her. And that, in effect, and in reality, she knew he had never attained a true level of intimacy with her sexually. And so this was a great concern because in her mind, whether true or not, and I think the reader will discover it most likely was true. But in her mind, if she didn't address this almost immediately, he would replicate all of the aberrant behaviors and eventually all of his illusions about intimacy, and especially with her, and would therefore destroy any chance of a relationship in the present life. Now, this is what was her gamble, because she knew that by instrumenting the sexual relationship very early, this would come up so fast that she might not be able to take care of it. But if she didn't do it early and attack it and break through it soon, he would gain so many, we'll say, antagonistic illusions from his prior life and add them into this life that he would probably leave her anyway. It was a gamble. And she hadn't tried this before based upon her memories from past lives, so she figured she better give it a try because in one of the past lives, she didn't have any sex with him for fear of having this whole thing blow up on her, and that didn't work out too well. So she said, well, going that direction isn't going to work, and going the midway didn't seem to work, so maybe this life, I just go for it. And so early on in Afterlife Love, this amazing woman chooses to effectively, I would call it seduction, come on pretty strong to our main character in ways that are fairly vivid, but not so bad, or so, we'll say, over the top that I would call it pornography, but it's strong. Why is it? Because the emphasis here is on her immediacy of getting a response and making sure that there is no misunderstanding of at least her motives, which she assumes she's going to have anyway, but she can bring them up and directly deal with them because now she is conscious of, from her memory of past lives, what to do and how fast she's going to need to do it. To the reader of the book, this is a problem, and as an author, it's a problem. Because since this is where she's coming from, and this is where he's coming from, Shane, the main character, it presents a problem to the author to not write a pornographic novel. But at the same time, to show that she's doing something that's really unusual. Because here's a very conscious person who is strongly coming on sexually to a man that she met just a few days ago, sort of thing. And it makes no sense to the reader at the beginning unless they continue to read. I've had a few readers, not too many, but I've had a few readers that put the book down after chapter two. You know, they say, it's got too much sex and I can't handle it. Unfortunately, they don't understand the nature of the sex or where it's really going to lead to. Because this is, the book completely turns around because of beautiful romance, amazing, amazing romance, with the most wonderful expressions of love between these people. But you have to get past these first beginning stages. And if you don't understand what I'm telling you now in a spiritual sense about the book, and most people don't know it, right? It can be perplexing to a reader who has a definable limit of reading anything that is overtly sexual in any respect. That's the problem an author can have, and I've had that. But I wrote a book that was genuine and that expressed real issues and real people having real factors going on. And from that perspective, to be true to the characters who were based on real people, by the way, I had to include these things, or else the story would make no sense. And besides that, you wouldn't see the change in our main man character, Shane, because you wouldn't see how he was and how he moved and how what Rebecca did actually worked eventually. It worked. It worked immediately. Of course, it was bumpy and not so simple as what I'm telling you. But the point is that it's as though she really got into the right place to be able to deal with him. There were crises, and certainly it didn't go all smooth. The book is not without some pathos and with some problems and issues. As a matter of fact, significant levels are present, but that's part of a lot of things that we read about or live. So why should it be any different? And so it's true to the human nature and true to the soul nature, because Rebecca is an example of both, whereas Shane is more on the side of the human. And from the perspective of the reader, we see the book through Shane's eyes, not through Rebecca's. The things I'm telling you about are the revelation of Rebecca more than they are the revelation of Shane. I almost wrote the sequel to this book, and I might do so, called Rebecca's Story, which would have been the same book, but from her perspective, with some differences because they weren't always together, and other experiences and other things that happened to her in the afterlife. So there's a lot of things that could be done, and I still might do that. But at this point, I want to make sure that the readers of Afterlife Love are not so, we'll say, disillusioned in the first couple of chapters, two or three, that they say, oh, this book is some kind of sex pot thing or something like that. It's certainly not. But what it is it's a viewpoint of a person with distress. Shane has a lot of distress. And part of it deals with his own sexuality and his way of dealing with intimate sexual experiences and with relationships that include sex, period. Okay, the other side of this is we had that third character I mentioned, Craig. He also shares some of the same sexual illusions that Shane does, but he does so with higher consciousness. So he has a, we'll say, more open mind, a willingness to change and explore himself a bit more on his own without having to have a Rebecca in his life. And he also meets another a woman who he is able to replicate some of the things he sees Rebecca is getting at with Shane, take that and borrow that, and then on the other side, the woman he's with, that Craig's with, again, I know I put too many names and we're going to lose the story if I keep going with all the names, but that woman starts doing the same thing. So all of a sudden, we have Rebecca not only as an intimate lover with Shane, but she becomes effectively a teacher because they see her doing certain things. And then later on, strange as it may sound, Shane starts becoming a teacher, so to speak, by imitating Rebecca's consciousness. Not in an imitation of the sense of copying, but imitating the openness and the willingness to change. Now you could say, well, what is all this leading into? It's because the book's about afterlife or love, right? It's not just about any old kind of thing. Well, let me explain something. This book is multidimensional, not just in terms of time and space, which it certainly is, because you learn a lot about the afterlife, but it is multidimensional in terms of the profound level of changes and feelings and expressions of intent and love and even anger and hostility and people's ignorances, and so many things come out in this one story. As a matter of fact, when I occasionally reread any part of it, I'm amazed at how complex it is, yet it is the type of story that you keep, every time you turn a page, something new is going to happen. And you can't predict very well what's going to happen next. I like those kinds of stories. Some people don't. I've met people that say one of the things I hate about the book is that it's not predictable. So they feel like, oh, gee, I don't know what's going to happen next. And they don't like that, which is odd. I think most people do like that, but there are some that don't. They want a traditional kind of thing where it follows a certain pattern, and they're used to that kind of writing, etc. Well, the good news is I'm not a traditional author, because I don't even think of myself as being, quote-unquote, an author of anything fictional. But granted, that may be true, but I did write a novel, so I have to say that way. have that in my on my resume, so to speak. But I don't think I am typical in the way that I approach it. And so in this situation, the spiritual issues were the strongest parts of what needed to be in place. And the story took its own dimension based upon the characters' likely ways of reacting and acting. And I could talk about this in a truly, we'll say, esoteric way, that to me, the characters took over the book, and I just put down on paper what they were saying. I know that sounds like crazy, but that's exactly my experience in writing it. Now, for a lot of people, they're going to look at me and say, okay, take them away. That's okay. He probably, maybe he should be in Slaughterhouse 5. You know, maybe he deserves to be like that crazy guy. No, the thing is, no, it isn't that I lost myself in the story. Is it that the story itself had a certain structure to it based upon the real people's existence, and all I was doing was filling in the blanks, and the story took its own direction, that's all I can say. And I really believe I was writing down what these people would have or did actually experience and say. And you should know that the book is based upon both a diary and a journal of Satan. That's what the book's based upon, and there really was such a work done. Okay? There really was. That I used certain elements from. So the book has a lot of reality to it, because it's something that is exactly what happened. And I tried as much as possible to keep in line with the expression of the people, so that there would be some level. As a matter of fact, the character of Shane, his real name was something else, of course, actually worked at the very place I said he worked at, but I didn't include the whole name in the book because there's, you know, you don't want to name a real business because you might have some reaction to the people in that business, to the book. Okay, so anyway, getting back to some of the elements here. These people go through a change in their interactions together through, we'll call it not quite a year's time when they know each other. Really, it's less than that. And during this period of time, they grow eventually to understand each other. Shane becomes less selfish. Rebecca becomes even more of a teacher and is able to literally lead quite a few people into a higher level of consciousness and a more spiritual service kind of life. And she does so in her businesses, which is, the book. Everybody thinks that spirituality means you run into a cave and you don't do anything. No, she has businesses. She's a staunch capitalist, for those of you who may wonder about that. And definitely not a socialist or communist kind of thing. People that I meet that think of group consciousness think that it has something to do with those kinds of things. It's exactly the opposite. Exactly the opposite. She's a capitalist. She has businesses. She creates those businesses in ways that help others to do the same thing. And she employs people. She does a lot of things that we would consider to be like, oh, that's kind of normal. But she does so for the purpose of helping to grow virtue in the world, and not necessarily for just making the most amount of money, although that's part of her life, and she does well making money. She's not poor, and she's not a person who is incapable of earning an income off of small businesses that she has. And she also helps Shane to get out of the concept that he had to work for someone or work for a big concern or do something that was highly structured. that may have been in line with his educational background, but she helps him to see life in a much bigger way. And eventually they actually co-create some businesses and do some other things together, very interesting. At the same time, Shane has many conflicting elements that prevent him from seeing the world the way she does, and he has to go through these. He actually virtually goes bankrupt because he loses the main job he had, and he has to face the issues of a recession and other issues that are happening. And he also has to deal with parts of life that he thought he had taken care of. And he gets angry. He doesn't like Ageless Wisdom because there's things called karma, and he thinks that it's all a bunch of nonsense. And then when things go wrong for him, he doesn't want to admit that maybe there's some karmic aspect. And on and on and on. So and for a while, totally rejects a spiritual life. And part of that time, he is not with with Rebecca. He's still friends with his old partner, old friend, Craig, but even Craig moves on, becoming more spiritually developed in his life. And yet, kind of is able to keep a toehold in what is a depression for Shane. And during that time, Shane is really coming to grips with his sexual issues because of the nature of his selfishness. Rebecca moves away from him, and he even almost starts another relationship with somebody else, and he goes pretty much nutso on that. The interesting thing about it is all the time she is at a distance, more in control of the situation than the reader may assume. Because from the perspective of the author, myself, I see this woman really getting her act together and able to now deal with what was an overbearing male interest in her life, sexual male interest, intimate sexual male interest, from her prior lives, where she couldn't deal with him. Even was virtually unable to even communicate. And so this time she has a whole different plan, and she is able to accomplish a great many things. That's the promise of the novel, in the sense that people can work through some of the past life issues and do a lot better. Now, eventually, the two reach a point where they get back together. They're doing fine. Much of their future seems promising. And there's an unfortunate occurrence. Rebecca ends up no longer being part of this world, and she's gone to the other side. And I'm giving up some of the book. I don't like saying that, but I can't really talk about it in this show this way unless I tell you at least that much of the story, right? And so our poor Shane is stuck here. And to him, this is an unbearable existence because they're both very young and he can't see living the rest of his life. They're both in their 30s at this point. The rest of his life without her. And there's another thing about time dilation, and he finally understands what that is, that for every year here, she could be living 21, 24 years on the other side, in her reality. And, of course, he has to face the possibility she may find somebody else over there, because, after all, hundreds of years may pass, and she might go on to live in another dimension before he even dies from this one, and he may never catch up with her. This is a huge disappointment, a tremendous strain. And most of the book deals with this conflict. And to our main male character, he is completely engrossed with it, to the point of almost giving up on physical life, which is never a good thing. And I enter into the story more at this point as my alter ego character, explaining to him that he has to still live here and that he can't just give up. And you certainly don't want to commit suicide, but a secondary realm to suicide might be to just think about nothing other than not being here. And so our main character kind of makes a deal with himself and his soul, a little bit with my alter ego character, in which his presentation is to search for Rebecca in the afterlife. Not so easy to do, by the way, because it's really seven subworlds, and it's pretty complicated, and you're limited by your own consciousness where you end up. Rebecca was far more conscious than him, and he knew he would have trouble even getting near where she might be located. But he figured she might come to him, and he hoped that would be the case. But the danger of out-of-body travel, which is put plainly in the book, is that every time you do it, you lose some sense, there's possibly a losing consciousness, and becoming more and more selfish and lacking empathy. And so he's forewarned about that by, of course, my alter ego and stuff he's read, but he decides to take the risk because this relationship means everything to him. And he further believes there's some other reason for them to still have contact together. I actually argue against that, but it turns out that I'm wrong. So the I being my alter ego. And so the whole book has a whole new nature to it. When we look at this from the perspective of the reader is now going to be engrossed in the most amazing either science fiction, if you want to believe it that way, or the most amazing spiritual story that I know about. And I know about the movies that have been made, you know, and all the, you know, the best movie I've seen on this subject, by the way, is Made in Heaven. It's a movie very few people have ever seen. That's a pretty good movie about the astral life and stuff. It's kind of a mixture of the mental world and the astral world together, but it doesn't matter. It's not too bad. Now, there's the one with Robin Williams and all that. Those movies are more spectacular, but not very nice. At any rate, getting back to our situation, the characters in this, as soon as this monumental event takes place, we have a total shift in the story. Now, this whole thing happens in the first less than third of the book that they're separated. So a lot of people say, well, why is there so little time spent in the physical world? Well, actually, there is a lot of time. There's a lot of events that take place. It's just that it's dense and it's very compact. And so, this book is about the afterlife, afterlife love. I wanted at least two-thirds or more of the book to be about that. It made more sense if you think about it. And so that's where, well, I think we'll take a little break at this point, but I want to come back to this and talk about what the afterlife did to these people and how it is that it could be somewhat of a meaningful tale, even though my alter ego so vehemently warns not to do it and thinks that it probably is a big mistake. It doesn't quite turn out that way. And that's not to be self-defecating or anything. I'm not saying, you know, that, hey, I want to make myself look terrible, and I want to look like I'm some kind of idiot who can't do anything right as some kind of means of having humility. No, it's that nobody could really understand this, what was happening to these people, unless you were them from the beginning of many lifetimes before. And the facing issues and other factors really has to do with someone who could never know until you're into the story and realize from the perspective, particularly of Shane, what it is that he's facing. The book really pulls on the heartstrings, if you ask me. Okay, so let me tell you some things. I recently have had the experience of, I'll try to find his name in here somewhere. I'll find it. Going to see. Hi, here it is. Dr. David Stacy over at the Eye Center. And I mentioned him several times. I want you to know that one of the things I find about him is he is just really open to trying different creative approaches to solving problems in vision. And most of the eye care professionals I've dealt with in the past are pretty close-minded, possibly because they don't want to take the chances that you can take when you inject a tech when you try something new. But also, it's just, you know, that's just the way you think. And the thing I like about Dr. Stacy is that he is willing to try just about anything if he thinks it will be of some assistance. And the other thing is his fees are reasonable, and he tries to be helpful for people who can't afford things, which is great. I like that attitude in him. I think he does a tremendous amount of volunteer work. That is terrific. I really commend him for that. And also his two assistants, I think I'll mention them, Lorraine and Christy, they're great people. They try to be helpful and do what their jobs are. And if you live anywhere in the Phoenix area, you should check out the Eye Center at the southwest corner of Alma School and Elliott and Chandler. And you can look him up at theeyecenter.org, or you can call 480-899-0188. And it's 480-899-0188. If you're anywhere in the area, be a good thing to try to see him, because he is just a great guy. And I think you'll like him. I think you'll find he's helpful and thorough. And it doesn't matter sometimes if people are waiting. He doesn't like to keep people waiting, but he will take the time necessary to do his job in a thorough way. And that's another thing I like about him. Many other good qualities, but I'll talk about him some other time in more detail. And for right now, we'll go back to our story and see if we can, how far we can get. And again, if we can't get far enough that I feel comfortable that I've given you the true spiritual meanings that I think are so critical in understanding what we'll say is the story behind the story. How's that? It's a story behind the story. It's another way of looking at it, and it deals with so much that is truly, I think, the backbone of afterlife love. All right, so eventually, our male hero here, sometimes an anti-hero, is convinced that the only way he is going to be able to survive in this life is if he can maintain some kind of connection with Rebecca in the afterlife. And this is no small feat, let me tell you. First of all, he has to learn how to have out-of-body experiences. But the most difficult thing is not having the experience. It's remaining conscious enough to go someplace where you're not with a bunch of really selfish and, let's say, manipulative people. And he learns all too well that that is the big problem. And he is not very successful in achieving his initial goals. As a matter of fact, he fails in ways that are outrageously bad, sometimes to the point of being grossly, outrageously bad. And this is because he hasn't spiritually disciplined himself the way that Rebecca did. He did a little here and there when he felt like it. Other times he was lax, sometimes he was selfish, he didn't think it mattered, and now it really matters. One of the problems of spiritual discipline is if your motive to do it is to gain something for yourself, it never works. So he's caught in that problem, and he has to deal with a lot of the illusionary problems that anyone who tries to enter into a spiritual life he has to deal with. And it's all accelerated in a very short period of time, in months, instead of the many years, decades, or longer, sometimes lifetimes, that he would normally have to do this. So you get a compacted view of what it means to go through the foibles of spiritual discipline. And how come so many people fail at it? And when they do, sometimes they become some of the most obnoxious and selfish people you can imagine. And because the failure in itself comes from spiritual ambition or some kind of self-desiring result. It may not be just that they be special, but maybe, as in his case, he'd be together with someone. And he's caught in the crosshairs between real love for Rebecca and the illusion of love that comes with the belief that only through, we'll say, the intimate contact he could have with her, involving a lot of sexual issues, that he could still really be with her. So he's continuously plagued by jealousy. And as amazing as it seems, this causes him to become grossly unfaithful in some ways and to lose complete sight of what he even is trying to do. All of these things come together finally to the realization that he is not going to succeed unless he starts serving much, much more in a real integral way, in a real meaningful way. And he's helped by Craig with this and others. By that point, Craig's wife helps him too. And they get this, he gets finally the awareness that Craig is more conscious than him and that he really needed some help because he wasn't seeing the truth of the situation. So it's through this strange vehicle of seeking an afterlife love that he discovers his soul. Not his small self, because he had discovered more of that earlier in the story, but the higher self, the part that serves others, he starts to discover that. And this starts taking on a greater meaning in his life. And then he finally gets to meet and be with, for a very brief period, Rebecca, under circumstances that are not the most pleasant, actually. But eventually, his desire for service connects him to Rebecca's desire for service in a common way. I'm not going to explain that part. And through the common need to serve one in the other afterlife in the other world, in one here, they develop a newfounded relationship. And his life takes on a whole different meaning. It's so remarkable that eventually he is able to succeed to get off of the ground floor of the astral world, meeting some really despicable people. And it reaches levels that are fairly high for any human being, really. He also meets relatives, eventually, and dear friends in the astral world, and starts to have a dual life at times. Plus, he is starting to gain the experience of serving in both worlds, while Rebecca, strangely, starts serving in both worlds, too, in ways that I'm not going to explain. And so they start joining together as one being in consciousness. Now, I will tell you this, that earlier on in the story, before all this takes place, I'm kind of doing a little reversal here, and I didn't want to bring this up yet, they actually have some remarkable sexual experiences while they're both physically alive. They have out-of-body experiences at making love together, and they also reach higher levels of consciousness together. These are remarkable things, by the way. And it's called tantric lovemaking, for those of you who may know that word. But the most important part about it is that these experiences became lasting enough so even after the death and the recontacting, etc., it became a glue that allowed them to manage to go through Shane's selfishness and, we'll say, goof-ups. And it allowed them to realize that sexuality is a way of being the other person for a while, a short time relatively, but still experiencing their consciousness if you reach a true spiritual level of sexual intimacy. And once they discovered that, that held them together and made the rest of the story possible. And this part, again, could be much misunderstood. It wasn't the sex that made it possible. It was the ability to be the other person in consciousness and experience the sexual intimacy from their perspective, not just in thought, but in sense as well. So you feel what the other person feels. Quite unusual experience. Now, in the astral world, this is actually more easily done by people who are less spiritually advanced than these people eventually become. But in the physical world, it's almost impossible to achieve. So here they were already having some astral kinds of sexual intimacy while they were still physically alive. And then they continue this and are able to bring it into the astral world at times, and it keeps them connected. It shows one of the true greatnesses of God's invention of sexuality for some beings, especially human beings, because it allows us to finally be someone other than ourselves at times. And if you do it well enough and long enough, it can be all the time. This gives us a whole new perspective on what it means to be with someone. So they develop the kind of closeness of a relationship that very few people ever do in any dimension of time and space, and especially in the physical. That's what's so wonderful about astral life love. You get to see a love story that goes so deep that sexuality is no longer an embarrassing read of some kind of pornographic nature, but instead becomes a maturity of oneness. And you see this develop mostly in Shane, because it's in his perspective. You see him go from this extremely narrow and very selfish and extremely exploitive element of sexuality to the most intimate, most close, most loving means of being with someone else. And this was one of the things that I wanted to make sure got through in the book, so that you could see that he became some other person but just by this one element, if not many, many others that are expressed at the same time. And that's the reason this particular, we'll call it fetter or serious problem of his nature, was able to be overcome and not thrown away or ignored, but developed into a godly expression. And truly, these people experienced God eventually in their lovemaking, and you can read it in the story. That's what's so wonderful about it. It's directly in front of you. It is not some hazy, funny thing. It's fairly direct, just the way all of the moments in the story are direct. The purpose is that he is a direct person. Even if he's failing in his consciousness, he at least sees things very much like an engineer, which is what he is. And so he says things very matter-of-factly. Some readers are put off by that in the beginning of the book. Then they realize by the end of the book, this makes a lot more sense. Because now, to the reader, you get to get the direct experience without there being a bunch of hazy kind of flowery speech. This was his vernacular. His vernacular was of a person who was a kind of a scientific engineer guy who wasn't writing a flowery novel. It was his experience. So I wrote it from that perspective. Is it missing what many people consider to be the artistry of novel writing? Yes. This is not anything like a typical romance novel is written. The antithesis of it, if you want my opinion. And it's more, it's a little bit more like a, you know, Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens in the vitriol of their character in the actual feeling of the nastiness or the the bitterness, the vitriolic missing elements that he puts in his characters. I might say I'm anything like him in, as an author, but this is that kind of story it is. So it's a story in which you're not going to see the author injecting his own prose. Rather, it's the direct and almost direct thought and dialogue of the people in the story, and especially of Shane. So you're getting this from the main character and male character and main female character, along with his friend. The friend sort of falls out after a while, because once they are interconnected in an afterlife, there are all kinds of new characters have to enter into it, because those people are living there, not here. But there's so much that is revealed in each character. Each character has their own story. We're talking about 60 characters plus. Each character is explaining the inter-involvement of Rebecca and Shane from their perspective, and at the same time are interacting with the with these main characters while they're interacting with many other people. And you can see how the afterlife is a continuation of grace and a continuation of consciousness building, and it's a way to slowly get back to being your soul. It's an amazing expose of what it's really about. And in a spiritual sense, this was what I intended it to be. But in a real sense, there could have been no other way to write the book unless I wanted to write a complete fictional kind of thing. There are some parts that show the deficiencies in consciousness and in technology and development of civilization that exist in some parts of the astral world. The astral world is really these seven sub-worlds plus the darkest place, where the sometimes called the eighth sphere. Where there's no part of that in the book, because the evil ones would never, they don't reveal anything about themselves. They stay evil. So when we look at this perspective, or when we see it from that character element, it is a story that reveals not only the intimacy of these two people, but all of the other main issues that are relevant to life after death, at least in the astral subworld. And it gives the reader a lot of things to think about, and a lot of facts. And the story has many teaching elements in it. Rebecca teaches numerous times, and especially besides in the physical world, she actually teaches more in the astral world during the course of the story. And eventually there's a little bit of that going on from the standpoint of Shane as well. So these people are becoming spiritual teachers, and they're helping other people to learn and understand both metaphysics and the spiritual side of life. They teach the same thing I teach, which is ageless wisdom. Their perspective is not exactly the same thing that I teach, but their perspective is from their perspective, which is somewhat different. But it coincides, and it is certainly not contradictory. The process of the book is to bring the reader into a new form of consciousness without it being too didactic, which means teaching, but with some element of teaching in it occasionally, and without it being focused too much on just the good or just the only virtuous side of existence. It shows a lot of selfishness. It shows people who are functioning from ways that are, we'll say, not virtuous. And it shows how our characters, main characters, are trying to deal with these other people who are doing that, and why a God allows the universe to have such freedom that people can screw up and do bad things. Yet, there's still the hope that they can change that, and they can. There's a tremendous amount of hope and promise in the book. And I find that as a person reads through it, at least from my perspective, gain a more optimistic viewpoint on life than they might have otherwise. That's a big part of what afterlife love is. It leads to a reasoning of a perspective in which a person can think through most of life's problems and come up with a rational way of being positive about how life ultimately is going to end up. And it gives the perspective also of courage, because there are elements of conflict in the book, particularly against some dark forces and other things. And it shows how there, by overcoming most fears, people can deal with the most obnoxious and terrible of consequences and commissions of we'll say hostile issues, and still be able to be victorious regardless of how the odds seem or whatever the circumstances may be. There's a great number of times when the reader may think, well, maybe they're not going to really be successful here. And through both courage and through consciousness, love, and also a lot of creativity and purpose and willfulness, the story turns into a true heroic, which I call these people heroes, heroic kind of adventure. It is not a single one-sided issue, though. Not every battle is a victory. Not every exchange is positive. And it does. It has so many complicated sub-stories. Some of them don't necessarily seem like they're going to turn out okay. Most of them do, but eventually. But people have many failings, and sometimes it just there's nothing you can do for them. It's just going to be the way it's going to be for a while. That while may be a long time, though, in terms of our terminology of years. So part of afterlife love is actually a journey. It's a journey for the reader through the eyes of shame, mostly, discovering their own issues and putting themselves in the place of shame to see how they might react, which may not always be coincide with his reactions, and also seeing how others react to him and deciding how if that would be true to their reaction. And it also leads to an amazing array of, we'll say, aha moments. I love those aha moments where you sort of say, oh, so that's what it is. There's a lot of those throughout the book. And that, to me, makes the book very worthwhile, even exciting to read. Because I don't want to have, you know, if you have an aha moment every other page, that in itself can become redundant. You have to earn the aha moment as the reader by going through the problems that Shane has and other people have, working through them either the way they did or whatever ways you might see, and then having an aha moment. The aha moment is almost exclusively in this book about discovering something else about God. The book is ultimately a journey in discovering not so much yourself, although one could say certainly there's parts of it that do that. The book is about discovering who and what God is. And so much of the story eventually becomes just that. I mean, it's sort of like the whole, as you move through from chapter to chapter to chapter, you're moving through this, we'll call it, tunnel of light towards God, and you don't even know it, because at first it seems as though the universe is just all screwed up with what the things that the story eventually or originally involves itself with. And then gradually revelation of God is coming through. And it becomes more and more that that's what the story is really about, especially as Shane and Rebecca reach the higher subworlds and they start serving in those subworlds with others. And at the same time, even the people who live in those subworlds, you get to see how they're struggling to understand God and the problems they face. And it's a truly, truly remarkable journey of going from a place of almost complete physical world, the most demeaning, minimal standards of life, which was where some of Shane's first happenings were, to a journey of becoming the hero in the book, and he and Rebecca become a proponent and a resource for seeing and finding God for all those who have interactions with them. That's what the story's about. That's what the true spiritual aspect of it is. And if we were to say, well, how come you couldn't do that in that textbook you wrote? The difference is that the textbook goes into the, we'll say, the elements of the science and metaphysics. Both of those are, to me, science, but so we'll say the physics and metaphysics of God, along with explaining how, and most importantly, why things are the way they are, concepts. Whereas afterlife love employs the concepts, which are spoken about during the teaching parts, but employs them as part of the story. So you're living the concept through the characters' lives. Now, I say characters, I'm talking about all 60 or whatever number it is exactly around. So characters' lives in the book, you're actually getting glimpses of God through each one and starting to see a bigger picture for the whole book. The book gets bigger and bigger as you read further into it, and that's not by accident, it's by design. The spiritual meaning of the book, therefore, grows, and the elements of the love story become something much greater, which I talked about a little bit ago. And so every part of the book gets bigger. Now, at the very end of the book, again, my alter ego is kind of in there, but only to wrap up the story to some extent and not to put me in as the centerpiece of anything. So, again, it isn't that I necessarily come out as some kind of hero or great teacher or anything like that. Rather, what it is that I'm just a place setting for anybody else who might have gone there and seen the changes in these people and how they grew to amazing levels and discovered godliness in the process. They also helped so many other characters in the book to do the same thing. It's so profound that I would say that it is much more than a love story of two people. It's a love story of two people for God. It shows how much they find to love about God through all their experiences of others having trouble in some way with God or about God, where they help them to overcome those troubles and to experience the more meaningful element of realizing who and what God really is, or at least what they think it really is, and what I, as the author, think it really is. And from that perspective, there's so much more gained. And then someone who reads this book, the purpose in overall is that they then could turn to life's hidden meaning, or many, I've written hundreds and hundreds of articles, or many other sources, these radio shows, and get so much more out of that experience, because they have seen the bigger picture and now can put their mind to studying as well as disciplining themselves spiritually in service so they can serve others and help create some good in the world, help create some virtue in the world, and do so in ways that that is exemplary and really is really makes their life something special. And that's why Afterlife Love is a good book to be read probably before rather than after for many people. A textbook like Life's in Me. It gives us the perspective and the encouragement to read something and to do something very difficult. It's an encouragement. The journey itself gives us a new way to, we'll say, foster in ourselves both courage and the willingness to change and be something greater than who we've been. And for those reasons, Afterlife Love has a great role to play. Some people told me, I don't want to read a novel after I read your great textbook, but they don't know what the novel is about. They think it's about, you know, just some kind of story about a guy who has a relationship with a woman in another dimension. It's far from that. It's so far from that that the book means a vast amount more to me than that one issue. Is that issue in it? Sure. But that doesn't mean that's what the book is mostly about. All right, so finding God, and finding God on a number of different levels, not just mentally, but also astrally, and in the physical sense, is what the book tries to do. It tries to bring the reader closer to an understanding and an experience through the journey of these people of what God is like. And the experience comes from their own growth. So God is the growth of life. God grows from the growth of life. And that's why life is. God created life so it can grow, because if it doesn't reduce itself in some respects and give this reduction as a gift to what we call life, then it can't grow either, because it would be all that it is and it could never be more. It can only grow by separating itself from the individual experiences of life so that individuality can live within group consciousness and the two can share and grow together. And so, to the main characters, and to many of the minor characters in the book, they start to experience this through the teachings of these people and their own lives together. And the people that they come in contact with start to realize what God is. And God is life itself in its growth. Not life in a static state. That's not God. As a matter of fact, if you stop growing life, that becomes evil. But when you keep life growing, the growth of life grows its creator. And eventually, on a conscious level, through human beings, beginning with human beings, we are the first form of life that can consciously grow God. Yes, our pets can borrow a little tiny fraction of that if they're intelligent and conscious pets, they could get a little tiny bit of that. But in general, animals or any life below human cannot. Rebecca brings this thought right into the beginning of the book. Right at the very beginning of the book, she mentions something of the order of what I just said to Shane, who says, wow, is that profound? But he has no understanding of it. He just thinks it's a profound thing. He can't really... doesn't really get it. At the end of the book, he not only gets it, but he is living it, and is living it with his love. And they even plan out far more of their life together beyond just astral life or mental life or any life. They're thinking about long times. Because now they see their perspective as being the perspective of the Creator. And from that perspective, there is no limitation. We are all living in a life that can be as unlimited as we are unafraid and we are willing to serve others and we are willing to face whatever is wrong with us at the same time be willing to change it and create better parts of ourselves and help others to do the same. And we see this from the perspective eventually, not just of ourselves, but this is the amazing part because it happens in the latter part of afterlife love. From the perspective of our own Creator, we start seeing our own lives and the lives of others rather than just from the perspective of ourselves. And that's probably the end miracle of afterlife love. If you can get that out of the book, then you're starting to see what the book ultimately leads to. Now, it doesn't go any deeper than that. And it doesn't go into the detailed ways of spiritually disciplining yourself or changing yourself into a soul-like being. It just is touching on that and allows the reader to think about it and then reach for other resources. So it is not, as a single book, a way of living. It's a way of encouraging people to change themselves and to eventually reach the point where they can be within God's mind and God's actions, interactions, and experience the universe from a greater perspective than a human being could ever. Where they might experience it as a soul, or maybe beyond the soul. There are such levels that they become encouraged that life is more abundant every day, never ceases to exist, and consciousness never is destroyed. The only thing that ever gets destroyed is the lack of consciousness because it serves no purpose and eventually destroys itself. But consciousness itself is never destroyed, which means that death, as we believe death to be, never happens. We lose bodies, we give up bodies, you see this throughout the story, but you never die in consciousness. And this is the gift that Rebecca and Shane, for so many times, help others to find. And that, with God's perspective of life itself, frees so many of the characters that they deal with and helps them become living souls, not just human beings. They start living part of their life together as souls and part of their service lives with everybody as souls. This is a true remarkable story, and I think I did it in an hour. Well, 2 hours, I'd say, but in one show, and that's pretty amazing in itself. I hope this book has made some sense to you, and if you haven't read it, maybe you're going to want to get a copy and look at it. And remember, if any part of it discourages you, read a little bit further, and if you really find anything that disturbs you, feel free to email me. We'll talk about it. I'm always available for that. Listen, I hope this has been an interesting show. It certainly, I hope, has been a spiritual review of Afterlife Love. And until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.